From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wise can help you manage your money in different currencies. With Wise, you can send money to your cousin in Australia in seconds. Travel internationally without having to brave an airport currency exchange desk or take the guesswork out of converting currencies. Wise lets you send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate, all without any hidden fees. Join 60 million customers already using Wise worldwide. To learn more about how a Wise account can work for you, download the app or visit Wise.com. That's Wise, W-I-S-E.com. Wise.com.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
There are conservative parties everywhere, but the Republican Party is the only party in the world that hasn't reconciled itself to the rise of the welfare state and the regulatory state.
Hello, welcome to Ezra Klein Show on the Vox Media Podcast Network. A couple weeks ago, I asked for ideas on people to interview about polarization and identities, and in particular, the ways that the Republican Party and the Democratic Party are fundamentally different from each other. Why have forces that are affecting both led to very different outcomes? Why did the Republican Party nominate Donald Trump in 2016, whereas the Democratic Party went with a much more traditional candidate? Why does the Republican Party seem to prefer shutdowns and seem to be more polarized both in tactics and ideology than the Democratic Party has become? What's behind that? The expert on this is a guy named Matt Grossman, who, along with Dan Hopkins, both of them are political scientists, wrote a really fantastic book a couple years back called Asymmetric Politics, Ideological Republicans and Group Interest Democrats. And it's about the fundamental differences in the two parties' coalitions, the way those coalitions look at the world, and how those differences explain what we see all around us today. Grossman, he's got a political science podcast called Political Research Digest with the Niskanen Center. He is really, really, I don't usually recommend people's Twitter feeds, but I really do recommend his. I think it is maybe the best way to follow new developments and new papers in political science. But this is very much a conversation trying to help me, and hopefully you, think through what is really different in the Democratic and Republican parties. Why have they acted and operated in different ways in this era, and how fundamental are those differences? I'm not sure I am bought into every piece of Matt's theory, but I think it is really the starting point for trying to understand this topic, and so I hope you enjoy it. My email, as always, EzraKleinShow@Vox.com. Here is Matt Grossman. Matt Grossman, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So why are Democrats and Republicans so different? Are they? Let's ask the big question. Let's go right to it.
I think there is a longstanding set of differences between the Republicans and Democrats. And we, my co-author David Hopkins and I, started kind of listing them. And we decided that they really amounted to one sort of global difference, that the Republican Party is a vehicle of a symbolic ideological movement, whereas the Democratic Party is a coalition of social groups. And there are incentives for each party to kind of continue on their traditional way. Republican leaders, by attracting loyalty to eternal values and reactions to social change, and Democratic leaders by seeking concrete government action through kind of a catalog of specific policies to respond to each of the group identities in their coalition.
Okay, so I want to push this because I think this is both a very interesting definition of it, and I want to understand where the boundaries of it really are. So how do you distinguish an ideological coalition from a social group coalition? I look at the Republican Party, and I know a lot of people talk a big game about limited government and so on, but it seems to me it's a party that has, you know, the Club for Growth, which wants lower taxes on rich people in general, not only rich people, but rich people. It's got the Chamber of Commerce, which is concerned about business interests. It's got a huge anti-immigration bloc. It had for a long time neoconservatives who worried about a hawkish foreign policy abroad. I mean, isn't this a coalition of groups that want certain things? things. Some of them, you know, based around their identity. Some of them based around, you know, their transactional material interests. Some of them based around ideology.
Well, there's certainly interest groups attached to the Republican Party, but they don't represent the social groups, the blocks of the party in the electorate. And they seem to talk a whole lot more often about broad values and kind of eternal principles than specific policy aims to achieve specific ends for Republican voters. So I don't want to say that there are no aspects of the Republican Party that look like a social group coalition, and likewise, there are aspects of the Democratic Party that look more like an ideological movement. But this is a quite longstanding difference between the parties, and we see some ways that it's likely to continue.
But I guess this is my question. To help me understand, when does a coalition of groups coalesce into an ideological movement, and when is what maybe looks like an ideological movement just actually a coalition of groups, right? This feels to me like a distinction we're making sort of sharply, but it feels a little blurrier to me. I mean, Democrats, like, as you say, tons of groups in there. You've got, you know, unions and the NAACP and, you know, Justice Democrats and all kinds of different players. But, you know, I think a lot, you know, when you're on Fox News, people step back. It's like, it's liberalism. And so to some people, it looks like one big ideology. So what is the line between these? Like, when does a group fall on, you know, this is a broad ideology versus this is a bunch of groups who have come together in a kind of transactional coalition to advance their goals?
Well, traditionally, each party has kind of seen the others more like a mirror image of itself. So, yes, on Fox News, they see it as a broad liberal movement that's trying to use government for its own ends, whereas the Republican Party is seen as just a bunch of white people and business people advancing their own interests by lots of Democrats. So I don't want to say that there's, no grounds to the critique, or that the parties don't ever change, but we found a very similar set of patterns over decades in our book, and we see many of them continuing. I think one thing that has changed on the Democratic side is that the groups are getting along a lot better than they used to. You used to have debates not just about priorities within the party that you still have, but debates about actual policy positions that the Democratic Party was going to take. And those have calmed down considerably. So in some ways, that is drawing from more of an ideological attempt to unify the groups. But it still turns out, at least in campaigns and in governance, to look a whole lot more like going down the list of priorities for each party member than it does like the Republicans who are trying to reorient government on sort of a global scale.
So there's a story that I think is pretty dominant within, you know, both a lot of the political journalism literature and the political science literature, that we've had a lot more polarization in the past 50 years, a lot more sorting of the two parties into more distinct ideological camps. But amidst all that, Republicans have gone much further to the right. The Democrats have gone to the left. Do you buy that basic story?
Well, it is certainly true in Congress that the Republican Party has moved further to the right than the Democratic Party has moved to the left, and there's more remaining moderates in the Democratic Party than the Republican Party. I don't want to say that is also automatically true of the electorate, because it really depends on how you define the positions of voters. Voters are mixed, and so it's actually sort of the Democrats who hold more consistently liberal policy positions, and the Republicans who more consistently think of themselves as being on the right and think of politics as a conflict over visions rather than a conflict over groups. So there's been asymmetric movement at the policymaker level, but things look different at the electorate level.
One of the things that I wonder about at that policymaker level is there used to be this view that the Republican Party was this organized, machine-like institution, and Democrats were this disorganized, ridiculous coalition of groups who couldn't get along. So there's the old Will Rogers quote, you know, I don't belong to an organized political party, I'm a Democrat. There is the longtime saw in politics that Republicans fall in line and Democrats fall in love. And in the past couple of years, it has seemed to me to be basically the exact opposite. Republicans seem very disorganized. They keep like knocking out their own speakers because a job is impossible. The party got taken over by Donald Trump in basically a hostile external takeover. The party does not seem to have control over its own interest groups. It seems much more, say, controlled by Fox News than it has any control over Fox News and talk radio. I'm curious how you think about that question of internal organization, because on the other side, Democrats have been pretty united. They took a lot of very tough votes in the Obama era. Nancy Pelosi tends to have pretty good control of her caucus, and even, very far from Boehner and Ryan, getting pushed out, like she lost a majority and then came back and held it again in the speakership. Something seems to have changed in how capable the parties are of internally coordinating. And I'm curious, again, if you think that's a true story. But if it is, what you think that change is?
Well, and that's the intellectual history of our idea, is that it's not at all a new idea. People have been saying that the Republican Party is more ideologically oriented, the Democratic Party is a more diverse coalition for decades. But in fact, they connected that to the outcomes that you just described. So they connected it to the idea that, okay, Republicans are going to fall in line and Democrats are going to be disordered. And then when those outcomes changed, the sort of idea that the parties were different kind of lost favor in academia. And so part of our resuscitation of the idea is to say, just because people are forming a party around ideological views doesn't necessarily mean that they are all going to get along and follow the leadership. In fact, there's that kind of a long tradition of distrust of one's own party as not standing for the principles of conservatism. And just because there's a group coalition does not necessarily mean that it will not form issue positions that each side can kind of take as a part of a log rolling arrangement. So we think that the outcomes of the difference between the party have changed, but the sort of underlying causes for those differences historically remain.
How does your theory there account for Donald Trump? Because Donald Trump is someone who has not traditionally been what we would have thought of as a movement conservative, does not, even in the primary he ran in, he would routinely stray in his public remarks from conservative views. He is somebody who came from the outside and like beat a lot of conservatives and mocked a lot of past conservative heroes. And yet he took over the party and has been extremely, extremely popular in it, which suggests to me, well, one read people have had on that is like, actually, it's not an ideologically conservative party. It's a white identity politics party. And Donald Trump has a better definition of what conservative actually is than Republican elites have had. And so like what we've just seen is a redefinition of conservatism, or other people have different views. But this idea of Republicans being a party that is much more committed to this ideology we think of as conservatism, it's a little bit hard for me to square that with the Donald Trump takeover.
Well, yeah, let me say that we did not predict Donald Trump's victory, and we think that there's certainly some idiosyncratic factors involved in his victory in the Republican primary, and that most of the explanations for his victory in the general election are sort of consistent with long-term political science about the parties each having a good chance to win general elections. So we're in no ways trying to be kind of the explanation for Trump. But I would say that there are, there are areas of consistency and there are real breaks. I think in some ways we've overestimated some of the breaks. So certainly in law and order rhetoric, in the racial impact on conservatism, in the long-term Republican shift against immigration, in the increasing role of conservative media as the arbiter of conservatism in the party. In all of those ways, Donald Trump is a continuation of long-running trends in the Republican Party. He really stands out when it comes to trade policy, but it's not clear that was sort of ever a big piece of what held conservatism together. Another thing I think I would just note now is that we don't know yet how much Donald Trump will change the party. If we were sitting having this conversation in the George W. Bush administration, we might say, okay, they've kind of moderated on health and education. They're sort of come to terms with their old isolationism and therefore nation building abroad. There's a rise in neoconservatives in the coalition relative to others. But all of those turned out to be quite temporary. And so we just don't know yet how much of Donald Trump changes he's going to bring to the party and how much we'll see a continuation. And one sign, I think, that it may not last forever is that he really hasn't taken much control of the Republican congressional agenda. It really looked about the same over the last 2 years as it would have looked under any of the other Republican primary candidates.
Isn't that because he's lazy? I mean, he did just make them shut down the government for a wall they didn't want and a shutdown they opposed. It seems to me he could control it. He's just like, you know, it's hard to control the Republican agenda when you spend 60% of your day in executive time.
Certainly, he's an ineffective leader and an inexperienced president, and there's no doubt about that. But he has brought people into the administration who have had kind of more success in regulatory arenas, and they've pursued pretty much the traditional Republican policy agenda. He also ran in the same way that Republicans typically run, on kind of a broad, unimplementable vision. So even if he were great at implementing it, there were never sort of enough viable details with a path to victory in the campaign that could really translate into successful governance. And that actually turns out to be pretty typical of Republican presidents. Where I think he did not follow some past practice that people haven't noticed as much is that most Republican presidents come in with at least some liberal things they want to do, often because those liberal things are popular. So we talked about George W. Bush coming in with extending health coverage for prescription drugs and nationalizing education standards as being sort of ways that he changed the Republican agenda. And Donald Trump actually sort of didn't have a whole lot of those ideas. And so there was sort of none of the traditional diversion that we get from the smaller government conservatism to kind of try to do some popular things in the administration.
But so here's my pushback on this, because I think that we get trapped a little bit in the Donald Trump we have, not the Donald Trump we might imagine we have. But Donald Trump, and it goes a bit back to what I was saying about him being lazy. Donald Trump did run with a bunch of liberal ideas under his belt, and they appeared at that time to be popular. He said he wouldn't cut Medicaid or Social Security or Medicare, although he proposed many Medicaid cuts and eventually some Social Security ones too. He said that he wanted everybody to have health care and he wasn't going to be a traditional Republican. I mean, he obviously dropped that immediately. But one of the reasons I'm pushing on this is that if the ideas of the Republican Party is a movement conservative organization, it is ideological and committed to this ideology we understand to be conservatism in a way the Democratic Party is not. You have Donald Trump, who has a lot of heterodoxies from what we traditionally understand of as conservatism, and he comes into office and, you know, it's a little hard to say what he could have done. I feel like I was much more convinced by the idea of the Republican Party as a conservative institution before it seemed to actually want Donald Trump. And it made me one thing that it did for me was it made the Republican Party look more like a coalition of bigger but nevertheless interest groups that had settled on a kind of mutually agreeable view of the party. It's like you had rich people who wanted lower taxes and less regulation. You had resentful whites who wanted who did not want to see a big government going to help non-white people. You had, you know, neoconservatives who had a foreign policy that was more aggressive. I mean, you can stack a couple more things on top of that. But that, you know, when somebody came in and said, actually, I'll give you a welfare state for white people, the party was like, great, that's actually what we wanted all along. We don't care about the National Review saying you're not a conservative.
Well, the trend of sort of rallying behind the president and rallying against the Democratic president turns out to be actually a fairly long-running pattern. There's an article that just came out that showed that, you know, this approval jump from Obama to Trump is not only normal but always bigger for Republicans. So there is a piece of it that's just, you know, we trust our own in government and we fear the opponents. I think part of it would help to think about the Republican Party in international perspective, which is, you know, there are conservative parties everywhere, but the Republican Party is the only party in the world that hasn't reconciled itself to the rise of the welfare state and the regulatory state, and maintains a vision, at least in campaigning, that is the furthest right of any major party in the world. It's a vision that is not capable of being implemented, not just by Donald Trump, but one that isn't quite so feasible. And so, yes, Donald Trump has differences, but I think a lack of connection between the vision and the policy details is actually some continuity. We're having this even in his highest priority of border security. He has proposed something that is almost entirely symbolic. Didn't even really present a justification for the details of the money to Congress. Meanwhile, Nancy Pelosi has a very set of ideas, and why have one when you can have 20 proposals for border security? And it's actually the Democrats that have this well thought out policy agenda for achieving that professed goal.
I do want to put a pin in this because I want to come back to this idea of, you know, there being a real difference in how the two parties look at policy. But I want to take one more beat on this question of what I think is a fundamental question of what is conservatism. Your book relies very heavily on this idea that the American public is philosophically conservative and operationally liberal, that they like the idea of smaller government and personal responsibility and the things we associate with conservatism in theory. And then they want more Medicare spending and more Medicaid spending and, you know, more liberal positions in practice. One of the frustrations I had reading the book is I often read descriptions of conservatism like that, and they don't sound to me like what conservatism ever is. That it's like maybe good branding, but you were talking about Donald Trump on Law and Order. That's not a smaller government, or George W. Bush invading Iraq, and just a generally more aggressive and expansionary foreign policy in general. Larger defense spending almost always is on that party's agenda. And so, you know, it often seems to me to be that conservatism is an interesting brand, but it has a lot of internal contradictions. And when you see something like that, you think, well, maybe it isn't the thing it says it is. Maybe it's something else. And so I think the thing I'm really trying to draw you out on here is Donald Trump actually a product of movement conservatism? And this is what movement conservatism really is? Or is Donald Trump a break from conservatism, as the National Review said he was? Because if he's a break from conservatism, it seems to me to be a problem for your theory. If conservatism needs to be understood as something that it doesn't always admit to really being, then it seems very aligned.
I think it's a moment where we're realizing some of both. So we're going back and reinterpreting some conservative history in light of Donald Trump, and we're seeing more continuity in some cases. And so that's causing us to rethink about what conservatism is. But I do want to just present the evidence for this sort of view that the Republican Party really does have a base of popular support, and it comes from these sort of broad sentiments that people have in the U.S. That they don't have in other countries. So even though actually Americans support lots of redistributive policies, they don't support the goal of redistribution or the action of the government taking on the responsibility nearly as much as people do in other industrialized democracies. And that does give Republicans a base of support. But a small government is not the only way that is expressed. There's also a broad resistance to social change that manifests in different specific policy areas, but can change quite readily from, say, gay rights to immigration. If you thought that it was about specific policy stances, you would think that was kind of an abrupt shift. But if you thought it was just kind of a resistance to America changing too much, then it allows itself to kind of manifest in multiple ways. Same thing with national security. If you thought about it as just sort of a generic might is right and America is best, then you can kind of see the George W. Bush foreign policy and the Donald Trump foreign policy fit under one umbrella, even though in policy terms they're almost, at least as presented in campaigns, quite distinct, if not opposite. So I think in that respect, in the fact that the policy details do not match the broad vision, and we sell the broad vision to the public, that is an area of consistency between Trump and past Republicans. But when we do get to the details, I don't want to deny that you do see breaks with Republican Party orthodoxy. I just think so far the Republican Party orthodoxy in the policy world is winning out to that.
Support for The Gray Area comes from Mint Mobile. When you hear secret sauce, maybe you think of the mysterious ingredient in your favorite burger. Or perhaps it's your grandmother's terrifying meatloaf, which somehow seemed to secrete sauce. But from now on, when you hear secret sauce, I want you to think about Mint Mobile. Their secret is that they only sell wireless service online. That means they can cut the cost of retail stores and pass those savings directly to you. By switching to Mint Mobile, you can get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. To get this new customer offer and your new 3 month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, you can go to mintmobile.com/grayarea. That's mintmobile.com/grayarea. You can cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/grayarea. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3 month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details. Support for this podcast comes from Greenlight. If your parents wrote you a blank check when you were 10 years old, what's the one thing you would have bought? I know for me, it would have been podcast futures. Or maybe that yellow Ford Ranger pickup truck that the lifeguards on Baywatch used to drive on the beach. That looked like a lot of fun. I don't know why I needed it. Didn't have the money anyway. But I wanted one. Would that have been a smart, long-term financial decision? Probably not. I would have learned that lesson the hard way. But what the Greenlight card wants to do is help your kids learn those vital financial lessons the easy way. Greenlight is a debit card and money app made for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. A colleague of mine here at Vox uses the Greenlight card with his two boys, and he loves it. You can sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free when you go to greenlight.com/grayarea. That's greenlight.com/grayarea to try Greenlight for free. greenlight.com/grayarea.
So let me ask you a bit about the Democratic Party here, because even as the Republican Party, at least in my view, has moved towards rallying around a leader who is less what I would call ideologically conservative, as we've traditionally understood it, than were his competitors or have past Republican presidents been, the Democratic Party actually seems to me to be moving in the opposite direction. That I would sort of mark this with Obama after Clinton. I remember that interview Obama gave in Vegas where he said, you know, Clinton was not a transformational president, meaning that he sort of operated within the Reagan, you know, the era of big government is over framework. But since then, you know, you had Hillary Clinton, who is running as much more of a liberal in 2016 than she'd been at other points in her career, and certainly than her husband had been, you know, whatever, 20 years before. And now, as I've begun covering the 2020 Democratic primary, there's this real, like, run to the left on Medicare for all and potentially abolishing private insurance. And, you know, say what you will about those ideas. I'm you know, like, assessing them, I think, is a different podcast. But it seems to me there is a much stronger urge in the Democratic Party right now to prove an ideological fidelity up to Bernie Sanders, you know, remaking the label socialist into something, you know, I don't want to say Democrats are exactly competing to be for, but many are very proudly adopting. So it feels to me the Democratic Party is getting much more ideological.
Well, the Democratic Party is certainly moving leftward in policy positions. I should say we have to wait a little bit to see how much it sticks. We do have a normal what we call a thermostatic pattern in American politics, where public opinion moves leftward under Republican presidents and conservative policymaking, and it moves rightward under Democratic presidents and liberal policymaking. And we saw that under Obama, and we're seeing that under Donald Trump. So public opinion has overall, including independents, not just Democrats, has moved leftward on policy. It has also moved leftward on ideological self-definition and even some base values. That gap is still there, where it's the policy positions are still more popular than the ideological label and rhetoric. Both are moving leftward. In the 2020 primary, there's no question that many of the presidential candidates that have entered so far have reacted, I think, to both Bernie's, at least people think that Bernie was successful, and so they are in some ways trying to appeal to that constituency.
What do you mean that they think he was? I mean, from where Bernie Sanders was like 15 years ago, his performance in the 2016 primary, I think, like, shocked a lot of Democrats. It seems to me to be very successful. It sounds to me like maybe you have a slightly counterintuitive view on it.
Oh, I don't mean to say that it wasn't a successful political project. It clearly was. I'm just saying we don't. One could just interpret it as he was the only candidate running against Hillary Clinton, and he got he managed to assemble a coalition of people who didn't want Hillary Clinton as the nominee. But that's not how the presidential candidates are interpreting it. They're interpreting it as there is a hunger for a leftward move, and that they need to satisfy it. I will say it was a little bit different in Congress. So we just had an election where there were some differences in the candidates that were in Democratic primaries, but there's no evidence so far that voters preferred the more liberal candidates across the board in House or Senate races. Many of the candidates that looked like they might be moving leftward in Congress have so far kind of hedged their bets and say, for example, joined both the Progressive Caucus and the New Democratic Caucus. So there's more sign of it in the presidential candidates than there is in congressional candidates and in Congress. But yes, I think there is a sign of it in both cases.
I think this is interesting data because if you're following Democratic politics just by reading political outlets and being on Twitter or even just watching Fox News from the other side, it's really like the Democratic Congressional caucus, the Democratic House, it is Nancy Pelosi and then her whip, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And like, those are the only two members of the entire House Democratic caucus. And so it does seem to me that there is a very strong, the dynamics in the media coverage and the sense people are getting from the media coverage is that there is this very sharp leftward swing in House Democrats. But you're saying that if you take a broader look at them, you don't see that as clearly.
Well, you didn't see it in the primary elections. You did see people taking on more liberal policy positions, but you didn't see the leftmost candidate winning disproportionately in the primaries, whereas you did see a huge gender effect, a very big shift in Democratic primary winners toward women being more successful. So there are some real changes in the congressional races, but they don't quite match the story. But as you say, sometimes the interpretation is more important than the sort of what the data say voters are supporting. And so I think that is why you're seeing some of these 2020 candidates really see their opening as having to appeal to the left. Although I think Bernie Sanders might, at least he hasn't entered officially yet as of this podcast, but I think he's in some ways an exception to the rule. I think if you had looked the day after the 2016 election, you might have expected him to be kind of the clear leader of this faction in the Democratic base, and that hasn't materialized yet so far. And it may be a sign that some of his support was based more on young people or people who wanted just something different than they were being given from Hillary Clinton.
Another cut on this is public opinion versus elite. Something you were saying earlier in the podcast is that there's actually maybe some evidence that Democratic public is more liberal than the Republican public, but the elites are much more conservative as a movement and the Democratic elites are more group oriented and policy transactional. But I wonder if you're not seeing something similar here, where certainly my impression is it the dynamic among what I would call Democratic elites, and I think this is true in Congress, I think it's true in political consultants, I think it's true in media elites. There's been a big rise in left-leaning and much more ideological media in the past couple of years on the Democratic side, is that the elites in the Democratic Party, both in their practice of politics and to some degree in their theory of politics, are getting a lot more ideologically liberal. When I entered politics, you still had a lot of, and began covering it, you still had a lot of influence of the DLC. And if you talk to members of the House and members of House leadership, you know, it's very much like the lessons of the Clinton era, and you had to see if you could win Georgia, which now you are seeing, you know, can you win Georgia? But it's a very different view of how you might win Georgia than how Bill Clinton thought about potentially winning Georgia. And so I wonder if even as some of the evidence you're providing here is really about the public. And I do not see a huge amount of evidence the Democratic public has moved way to the left. But it does seem to me that Democratic Party elites have moved quite far towards being a much more ideologically united coalition, and that there are other sort of force multipliers there around media and sort of the dynamics of ideological Twitter and other things that make me wonder if we're not seeing something that seems to happen in the Republican Party, where its actual organized echelons became much more ideologically unified and enforced that in ways ranging from primaries to money to kind of media opprobrium.
Well, there's certainly real trends on the media side. You need to look at the, you know, MSNBC versus Fox News ratings, and Fox News ratings are still going up, but MSNBC's have risen most dramatically under Trump, and so it does signal perhaps a desire for a more kind of upfront liberal perspective. One thing cutting against that is that the trust in the mainstream media has actually gone way up among Democrats as a reaction to Trump's attacks on it, which is kind of the opposite of what happened under Republicans. The conservative media was self-sustaining because they said, you can't trust the mainstream media, you can only trust us. And so far, we're not seeing that dynamic on the Democratic side. In terms of the elites in Congress and their perceptions, certainly there's a shift since the Clinton age in terms of levels of concern for being too economically liberal in their policy proposals. It is a little bit hard to compare over time economic liberalism or social liberalism, in part because policy tends to move more liberal over time, more often than it moves conservative over time. And that means that, by some definitions, the Democrats are kind of always proposing new things for government to do, or new social changes for policy to codify. And so in some ways, that is kind of an inevitable a liberal movement. But there's no question that the Democratic elites who used to really fear, say, a McGovern or a 1984 blowout, and see the route to redemption as being moderating on both economic and social dimensions, don't agree with that perspective, even though we're still having that debate today.
So this to me gets to something that is in your book that strikes me as one of the really profound differences in the internal dynamics of the parties. You were talking a minute ago about the way in which Democrats trust a pretty broad array of media sources. They trust the New York Times and the BBC and the Guardian and NBC, and they don't disproportionately prefer ideological outlets like, say, MSNBC in this case. Whereas Republicans, if you look at what they trust in the media, it's Fox News, conservative talk radio, Breitbart. They're like incredibly clustered around a certain set of highly ideological outlets. And then similarly, Republicans are quite distant from academia, whereas Democrats have, you know, very, very much embraced the kind of culture and institutions of academia. And having the party trust two sets of institutions that I think are, in general, try to be truth-seeking. I'm not saying the media gets it right all the time, but I think the media and academia both have a lot of internal, and I'm talking about the mainstream media, a lot of internal processes and cultural and even professional incentives to push against things that maybe are work within the ideology but don't feel true to them. Whereas the Republican Party, the information sources feel much more aligned with the kind of ideological dynamics. And that, if I were to pick anything that explains the difference between the two parties, I would I would pick that. But can you lay out some of that evidence and what you think its downstream implications are?
Well, yes, I would say it could explain more of the change than other aspects, because it really is something that has changed over time. That is, it was always the case that Republican elites were more distrustful of the mainstream media and academics to be independent arbiters of truth between the parties. But it really took a long time for them to make their Republican electorate share those views. And now they do to a very large extent. And as I said, the trends are actually in the opposite direction among Democrats. So it has been a big change, but it obviously grew out of Republican elites' resistance to both journalism and academia. We should say have always been disproportionately composed of liberals compared to the American public, and so they had sort of more of a reason to suspect that they wouldn't get a fair hearing from those two institutions. But over the last 50 years, they've really translated that into an ideological opposition to those institutions having any kind of independent, objective, arbitrating role. And in the process, built up a series of institutions that are designed to replace them, both conservative media, and then we tell a story about the rise of conservative think tanks at the elite level. As sort of replacing academic research and kind of causing what used to be liberal-leaning but trying to be nonpartisan institutions into being sort of their liberal ideological opponents. And so both of those two big changes in American politics that stem from a conservative elite's resistance to mainstream institutions certainly have had a profound effects on American politics. And I think to our point, make it difficult for Democrats to go through the same kind of transition.
Here's my question about this. So it is clearly true, looking at these institutions as they exist now, that Republicans are clustered around ideological media and contemptuous, many times I would say, of academic institutions in a way Democrats are not. I think the initial rebuttal you get on this is, look, the media is liberal. And I think that it is largely true that the mainstream media is composed of people who are liberal and vote Democratic to the extent they vote. And academia is liberal. And I think that's true, too. But these are strange institutions in that they might be composed of liberals, but they don't want to be liberal. And to the extent they feel they're being perceived that way, they actually end up putting into play responses to try to move in the other direction. My question for you is this. I can understand why Republicans and conservatives rejected institutions that they felt didn't represent them. What I don't really understand is why they didn't build equivalent institutions to represent them. I remember Tucker Carlson getting up and saying, the right needs a New York Times. And then he started the Daily Caller. And whatever you want to say about the Daily Caller, I would say did not become the right's version of the New York Times. And similarly, you know, you don't have like a profusion of Wall Street Journal-like sources. You have this rise of Breitbart and, you know, things of and the Federalist and things of that nature. And so why isn't the demand there, right? I'm not surprised by there being different institutions or people wanting representation in these very, very powerful institutions. But in a way that doesn't seem to have happened on the Democratic side as much, Republicans seem to have they've rejected some of the underlying principles, not just the idea that the specific institutions were stacked with people who didn't agree with them.
Well, absolutely, but I think that's based in their different vision of politics. So if you just need an information source to evaluate different policy proposals to achieve specific ends, and you think that one is biased, you might create another one to do the same thing. But that's not what Republicans are in the project of doing. They're in the project of promoting a vision of the role that government should serve in society and the direction of social change and a kind of a restorative project that doesn't require those same kind of informational institutions. And when you're trying to appeal to the Republican public, that is not, again, very focused on detailed policy proposals, but instead sees America as engaged in kind of a life or death battle to retain its kind of best and unique status in in the world, that's going to get a different kind of media coverage than one that appeals to Democrats.
I sort of get that, and I think I sort of don't. So, I mean, I've looked at a lot of this psychological research about what happens when you put Democrats and Republicans in, you know, basically in a lab or on a survey, and you give them ideological or partisan information about what they're seeing. And on an individual level, Democrats and Republicans don't look very different. I mean, Democrats are very happy to switch their opinion if they think that the people they ideologically follow have switched their opinion. They're happy to kind of rate the trustworthiness of experts by whether or not those experts end up agreeing with them. And so I would expect, if the theory you're offering is right, to see that brought down to the individual level a little bit more often, that there's just kind of a difference in how much people think truth serves their needs. But I just don't see that. So I'm curious what the evidence is of it for you, because there's nothing in being more ideological versus being more policy oriented that would necessarily make you less concerned about, you know, what are the true facts of an issue.
Well, I don't want to review the full literature, because there's sort of big psychological debates about
this is a podcast. Review all the literature.
Yeah, the extent to which Democrats and Republicans or liberals and conservatives are different. Just two quick points I would make about it is that they're often comparing liberals and conservatives, which is not quite the same thing as Democrats and Republicans. So they often leave out the least ideological Democrats. It is certainly true that if you ask policy-oriented questions of Democrats and Republicans, and you sort of give them different pieces of information, they will both try to gravitate toward those that already support their views, and they will evaluate sources of information on the basis of congruence with what they already believe. But I don't think that necessarily addresses the question of what kinds of information sources Republicans and Democrats seek in the wild, or why they might seek those. And I think there is quite a bit of evidence of longstanding differences in how Republicans and Democrats see the world and see the place of politics in it, and that does mean that they tend to gravitate toward different information sources. But I think even if it's only a small difference at first, it's one that the information sources that they're given tend to amplify. So, everything that you hear, if you listen to Rush Limbaugh for hours a day or Sean Hannity, reflects that vision that is at least assumed to appeal to Republican voters. Over time, they begin to see the world more in the ways that Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity do. And Democrats don't have those sources and don't change their opinions to match that perspective.
And so one thing that's interesting about that is it seems to me that there are two stories you can tell here. One is an institutional path-dependent story that, you know, for whatever reason, maybe it was a liberalism of academia and journalism, whatever it might have been, Republicans just kind of got off the train and then ended up following Rush Limbaugh and Bill O'Reilly and Fox News. And, you know,
and we are mostly on that side, to be clear. We're mostly
on the side. Oh, really? Because that is not what I'm understanding from you.
That it's an institutional story, and that it was amplified by the institutions that were built by the right. But I just don't want to leave out the possibility that there are kind of inherent differences between liberals or conservatives. And I definitely don't want to leave out the idea that the Republican Party is just more uniformly people who think of politics in terms of ideology, and that those two things do provide a basis for the Republican institutions to develop differently.
Well, let me push back on the institutional story, if that's the one you're mainly on the side of, because that's a story I sort of want to tell in certain ways. It's a story that makes the most sense to me, given that I tend to see the two sides as reasonably similar on the individual level, given the research I've read there. But it does not then explain why there's never been a Democratic Rush Limbaugh. It doesn't explain why Fox News has over time just been wildly more successful than MSNBC. And it doesn't explain why Republicans didn't demand things that looked more like the things Democrats want, right? Like, why is Republican talk radio and Democratic radio is NPR, right? Which is just like a news source that has, you know, probably a liberal worldview in certain ways, but is not in any way out there trying to do movement liberalism. Is your view that it just could have, with a couple like key tweaks, you know, there never is a Rush Limbaugh, or he decides to go into some other profession, it just could have gone completely the other way. And we really do today have a Republican New York Times and Republican NPR, and things just look much more symmetrical.
Well, with talk radio specifically, I think that's a hard to tell story, because we did have the Air America alternative possibility that did have more enough resources to try to gain an audience and really wasn't successful in doing so. I do think it does get a little bit back to the coalitions of the parties. I don't think that there's no audience for something like a liberal talk radio. And I think that's why you're seeing some online sources that can be quite successful without necessarily needing to kind of be mainstream sources that take more of an approach that matches traditional conservative approaches. But I do think the Democratic coalition is quite diverse. So some in media consumption, for example, you have obviously 40% of the Democratic electorate is racial minorities. There are large media infrastructures designed specifically to reach racial minorities and their interests. We have Democrats differ a lot in terms of their priorities and their demographics. And that means that they're in some ways better served by a more diverse media infrastructure than our Republicans.
So this issue of diversity, I think, is an important one. Here's a story that is a little bit of an alternative story, particularly in the modern era, to the one you're telling, but feels similar to me in some ways, which is, yes, Republican parties are an ideological party, and Democrats certainly look like a group party. But that the core difference between the two parties, the core ideology of the two parties, actually now has to do with diversity. The Republican Party, as Donald Trump has proven, is a party that is, as Ronald Brownstein calls it, the party of restoration, a party of people uncomfortable with the way America is changing. And that does ladder up into a kind of ideology. It's an ideology about what made America great at another point. It's a set of policy ideas about what you should and shouldn't do, like building a wall. And that for the Democratic Party, while it often looks from the outside like a coalition of groups, to the exact point you were making, it's actually got an ideology. It's why you see this huge rise in women candidates and a sharp rise in non-white candidates. But that ideology increasingly is diversity. That ideology increasingly is that a diverse America is a better America. And that leads to other things like you should do more to care for people who, are, non-white or immigrants, and, you should have universal health care. I mean, there are other things that layer on top of that, but that we actually now have two quite ideological parties, but the ideological divide really isn't small government, big government. In some ways, the small government, big government stuff is secondary to the diversity, non-diversity questions. And then it's just a kind of, it's a nature of the thing that the more diverse coalition is going to look like and have a lot more groups than the less diverse coalition. But that doesn't make it less ideological. In some ways, having a view that a more diverse America is a better America, and that demographic change is something to be celebrated and welcomed and spread through the political power structure, is quite an ideological view.
That's certainly how Democratic elites have traditionally reconciled the diversity of their coalition. And I think in the public, it's kind of hardest to tell that view. We looked in the open-ended responses that people give for why they support one party or the other for those kinds of statements about diversity. And you just see them a whole lot less frequently than you see just more basic claims about the Republican Party is for these people, the Democratic Party is for the public. You don't see the claims about the necessity of diversity or about the importance of egalitarianism or something that sounds like that any more often than you see just basic pro-government stances, which is not very often, where people say, government should have a role in society. So those are the kinds of ideological claims that you see among left party voters in some other countries that you don't see among Democrats, and that would more closely mirror what you see among Republican voters. I think there's more of a case to be made that the Democratic coalition kind of explicitly created this vision of diversity to kind of reconcile its competing groups, and has succeeded in at least making them not fight over actual policy positions as often, even though they're still fighting over what kinds of issues should be prioritized. I'm not sure that means that they need to win that battle. So if you're a Democratic politician thinking about what kind of message to send to voters, it's always going to be easier to just sort of do a generic kind of people versus the powerful kind of campaign to talk specifically about how you're going to tax the rich and how you're going to provide these specific benefits that Democratic voters want, than to sell a broader vision that you're trying to implement a new role for government and society, or that you're trying to bring about a new type of society in the U.S. And I think in some ways the Hillary Clinton campaign was a diversion from the Democratic mainstream that kind of showed up in the way that voters conceptualized the campaign. She did emphasize diversity much more than previous Democratic presidential campaigns, and particularly racial and gender diversity. And she was much less likely to mention class and to talk about politics as class conflict. And that showed up in the way that people reported what they liked and disliked about the candidates. This thing that Democrats have always, the number one thing people have said they like about the Democrats has always been that they're the party of the middle class or the working class. And the number one thing people say they like about dislike about the Republicans is that they're the party of the rich. And since you didn't hear that message coming from the Democratic presidential candidate last time, it also didn't show up as much among voters.
But this seems to me to be one of these questions where it's really important when we say Democrats and Republicans, are we talking about the party as a kind of coalition of policy demanders and elites and volunteers and like kind of intense, you know, partisans, or just like anybody who might vote for the candidate? Because everything you're saying actually seems completely true to me. And yet, you know, I think Hillary Clinton had that message because that was the way for her to win the primary. And it is true that she was more explicit on this than Obama was, but I think Obama didn't need to be explicit on this in the same way because of who he was. And when you had a guy who looked like Barack Obama, skinny guy with the big ears with a funny name, standing up and talking about hope and change, and, you know, there's never been anything unlikely about hope in America, it was clear what he was discussing. Similarly, Donald Trump's reaction, that seems clear. And I feel like one of the lessons of the book for me is that party elites create politics. I don't think you would have as ideologically conservative a Republican Party if it was really about what the broad base of the country wants. I mean, as you say, the big knock on the Republican Party is that they're the party of the rich, and still, like, huge tax cuts for rich people is what they do every single time. So it seems to me that, you know, as politics travels through that defining mechanism of what are the party elites doing, that this feels to me to be increasingly what the ideological divide is. And obviously it has these other things too, but I guess that's my question for you. Do you think this is changing? Do you think that, you know, the way we described American politics in the 20th century, which is this fight between big, like small government ideological conservatism and big government practical liberalism, is moving to become this fight over, you know, the demographics of the country and how you feel about that apportionment of political power?
I think there are changes. There is a rise in social issues relative to economic issues, not because economic issues are becoming less important, but because social issues are more important to young people and are becoming more closely aligned with partisanship. But I think we also should go back and evaluate that vision of the 20th century. And you know, the historiography, I don't think, tells that same story. They have always told it as being tied up with race, as being tied up with social change, as being about the role of religion versus other versus new social institutions, as being about the speed of social change. And it's always been true that the Republican elites have been more disproportionately focused on economics compared to the Republican base, which has always been more attracted to the party on the basis of a social vision.
I feel like we've slightly really flip positions on it. I agree with all that. What the distinction I'm making from the 20th century, a little bit implicitly here, is that in the 20th century, politics wasn't as organized around those cleavages because they didn't cut between the parties. I don't think it was, I think it was not your book, but Jeffrey Capasservice's book on Rule and Ruin about the fall of moderate Republicans, who makes a point that, you know, the Civil Rights Act could have been understood as a Republican victory as well. It just wasn't because Barry Goldwater then ran against it. And that, you know, when these fights were happening internal to the coalitions, politics didn't organize around them in the same way. They were suppressed because coalitions try to suppress their disagreements. But now that they're organized between the coalitions, they're becoming much bigger. So, like, I think America's 20th century politics are pretty fundamentally defined by racial conflict. And that includes sort of how the New Deal is built and all kinds of other things. But we remember it as small government, big government, because that's what the parties were most comfortable fighting over. Now it seems to me to be that they're like actually quite a lot more comfortable fighting over diversity.
There's no question, again, that there's been a change in the relative emphasis of those dimensions by party elites. I think even though we put lots of emphasis on the role of party elites in creating the differences between the parties or reinforcing them, I think we don't think it was nearly as open as say, Capasservice does. That is, yes, there were moderate Republicans, but the chance that they had to win in the party that was organized as it was after the 1960s was not very likely. And to the same extent, you know, Democratic elites were reacting to their opportunities in the American electorate. And to some extent, those opportunities have changed with increasing diversification. But that, you know, doesn't necessarily mean that they can kind of build the party that they want from whole cloth. That means that they have to kind of work within the incentives of their existing electorate.
Wyze is the app that makes using different currencies easy. Need to send dollars to your cousin in Bali fast? Getting paid in another currency and don't want to lose out because of inflated exchange rates? Want travel money without having to slog through the currency exchange kiosk? Then Wyze just might be your answer. From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wyze takes the guesswork out of converting currencies. You can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate with no markups and no hidden fees. In 2023, people sent over $100 billion worldwide with Wyze. What's more, over half of those transfers got to their destination in less time than it takes to listen to this ad. Whether you're traveling, spending money abroad, or doing business, let Wyze help you manage your money in different currencies with ease. Join 16 million customers already using Wyze worldwide. To learn more about how a Wyze account can work for you, download the app or visit Wyze.com. That's Wyze, W-I-S-E.com. Wyze.com.
Vacations can be tricky. You already know how to book flights and hotels, but now the only thing you're missing is, you know, the actual travel experience. Because is it really a vacation if you're just sitting around like you would at home? You need a tool to get the most out of your time away. That's where Viator steps in. You can book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected. And 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
So there's one more beat I want to make sure we cover here, which is the politics of policy versus the politics of purity. And in some ways, I think the strongest argument in your book is this idea that the Republican Party often runs its own political strategy and even its policy strategies very expressively to sort of show that it's truly against the things it says it is against, and it's shutting down the government and potentially breaching the debt ceiling and stopping Merrick Garland and on and on and on. And one reason it does not do compromise or even at this point internal cohesion very well is that it is about establishing that Republican Party leaders mean what they say, whereas the Democratic Party, because it's more policy focused, is much more open to half a loaf and is much more concerned about shutting the government down and is much more sort of willing to make these compromises. And that seems to me to explain a lot about American politics and why the two parties can't bargain. Because if Republicans don't care that much about the policy, then Democrats going over to them being like, we'll give you a quarter of the policy if you give us 10 votes, is not in general going to work. Can you just talk a little bit about what you think is the most compelling evidence that is true?
Well, first, I think it's based on this general pattern that policy that's enacted tends to be more likely to be liberal than conservative. It tends to expand the scope of government to new areas more often than contract it and codify social change more often than reverse it. And that means that Democrats are sort of always in a better position if policy advances, even. If they don't achieve their full vision, whereas kind of any action that's taken might actually be worse for conservatives than not doing anything. It's not that they don't have anything they want to do, but if they can't get that, then it might sound better to do less overall. And I certainly think you see the Republican Congress sort of just having a smaller agenda of achievable items than the Democrats. Whereas, you know, we started by talking about all the proposals coming in the 2020 primary that do sound quite liberal. But when we start thinking about trying to enact those in 2021, I fully expect the traditional Democratic patterns to return, even if they have full control of Congress, that they will seek to moderate their proposals to make sure something passes. They'll seek to incorporate various interest group demands and try to pacify opposition because they'll want something to show for, and Republicans just don't have that same priority.
It always strikes me as a little bit weird, though, because it doesn't seem to me. I very much take your point that most policymaking that does happen is liberal, and that relates to the fact that in terms of actual policy, the American people are liberal more than they are in terms of their philosophy. But Republicans often have the ability to get things that seem to me to relate to what they want. They just don't end up feeling it that way. So, you know, I think a really good version of this is taxes. The Republican Party has become so monomaniacal on taxes that they're not even able to take pretty good deals that would cut spending by a lot. I mean, you bring up in the book that moment in the 2016 Republican primary debates, I think it was a Fox News debate, if I'm not wrong, where they said, you know, who on this stage would take a deal that cut $10 in government spending for every $1 in tax increase? And nobody raised their hand, or maybe one person did, I don't remember, but definitely none of the major candidates raised their hand. And that doesn't seem to me to be explained by most policy that happens as liberal, right? Like most policy that happens, you know, even liberal policy that happens tends to have a much worse ratio than that 10 to 1. So that seems to me to be some other dynamic that is related to, I don't know, purity or philosophy or something. But you could, you know, like to the extent conservatism has policy instantiations, you could, like, you're going to have to take those sort of, like, you get 60 or 75% approaches to getting them. It's just, I don't know, like, maybe do conservatives not really care about the policy that follows downstream? Is that not the motivation? And the motivation is more philosophical and expressive? Like, what is... Why wouldn't they take a 10-to-1 deal?
So I think it's part of that. They don't care as much about the outcomes as Democrats. There are longstanding psychological debates about individual differences in aversion to compromise. And I think actually here, most of the evidence does support a more longstanding asymmetry between liberals and conservatives. But of course, they also hear different messages from political elites and have for a very long time about the necessity of compromise, and when the elites do change, you do see some changes. So there was a blip where Democrats were more averse to compromise under Trump. That seems to have returned a little bit to the normal pattern. So I think in both cases there's kind of a pre-existing tendency, and then messages that they hear from elites. One other thing I did want to answer was on the kind of potential for compromise, because I think people don't necessarily understand kind of what the historical compromise was, which is that it was Democrats trying to achieve their goals by kind of pre-compromising with what they thought were potential conservative objections. So American policy, compared to every other country in the world, uses the tax code more than direct spending. It tries to make states and localities in charge of implementation rather than central implementation. It tries to incorporate the private sector and market incentives. And so government has taken on a lot of new roles under the liberal expansion of government, but it tends to have done it through conservative means. And although that never fully satisfied conservatives, there used to be more that would kind of go along with that project that would sort of pretend to be in the interest of trying to kind of coax Democrats into moderating their new big government proposals to make them more consistent with conservative ideology. And we've sort of lost that potential for compromise as Republicans have shown themselves to be less interested in it.
I think that is probably a good place to wind down. So, Matt, let me ask you the question we always end with on the podcast, which is, what are three books you'd recommend to the audience that have influenced you?
So I thought I'd go with thematic history at the kind of intersection of our interests. So I'm going to recommend Racial Realignment, The Transformation of American Liberalism by Eric Schickler. Before the Storm, Barry Goldwater and the Unmaking of the American Consensus by Rick Perlstein. And Law and Order, Street Crime, Civil Unrest, and the Crisis of Liberalism by Michael Flam.
Matt Grossman, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you to Matt for being here. Thank you to Topher Ruth in Berkeley, to Jeff Geld in D.C., to Jillian Weinberger. The Ezra Klein Show is a Vox Media podcast production.
Canva presents stories to keep you up at night. It was an ordinary work day until
the Singapore presentation is at 3 a.m.
The office was shocked.
But that's when we sleep.
Maya made it less scary with Canva.
I'll just record my presentation so Singapore can watch it anytime.
Record and present anytime with Canva presentations at canva.com. Designed for work.
This podcast was supported by Choiceology, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Hosted by Katie Milkman, an award-winning behavioral scientist and author of the best-selling book, How to Change, Choiceology is a show about the psychology and economics behind our decisions. Hear true stories from Nobel laureates, authors, athletes, and more about why we do the things we do. Listen to Choiceology at schwab.com/podcast or wherever you listen.